sitting up comfortably tall. Let's recite Om three times. Inhale. We'll do the invocation to sage Patanjali. And if you're not familiar with it, just listen in. Inhale. Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena Yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. And what this invocation says is that I bow down with folded hands to the greatest of munis. Munis are the sages or the wise people, by the name Patanjali, who gave us the science of Ayurveda for removing the impurities of the body, science of Sanskrit grammar to remove the impurities of the speech, and the science of yoga through the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali to eliminate the impurities of the mind. So, once again, welcome everyone. Welcome, Susan. And you may just like to sign in your name, and then can you pass on that name sheet? And like I mentioned, we have been going through this discussion on the concepts of Sankhya, which is the central philosophy on which Yoga Sutras are based, Sankhya philosophy. And these sutras in the chapter 2 are basically giving us a very beautiful insight, a deep insight into that philosophy. So, since every one of you have this book, so we can use this book for at least reading the sutras, and then we'll see how we want to talk about them. Okay, like I said, so we went up to sutra number 22 last time. And just to bring you up to date on these concepts, I'm going to very quickly read through the sutras from, let's see which one will be a good, yeah, let's read from 15, and we'll just read the sutras and then read the translation. Okay, not a whole lot of discussion unless you have very serious questions. So I'll read the Sanskrit Sutra and then one of you can read the English translation. Alright? So number 15 is Parinama Tapa Sanskara Dukkhaihi Guna Vritti Virodhacha Dukkhameva Sarvam vivekinah. So, Susan, you can read the translation.
To one of discrimination, everything is painful indeed, due to its consequences. The anxiety and fear over losing what is gained, the impressions left in the mind to create renewed cravings, and the constant conflict among the three gunas, which control the mind.
Wonderful. You want to bring a question or something? You're okay? You're okay? All right. So, does everyone kind of get a gist of this sutra? Any serious doubts?
And the gunas are made up of what?
The gunas are the three gunas called sattva, rajas and tamas, which are the sattva is the guna of purity. Purity, cleanliness, all the nice feelings that we have. Rajas is the guna of activity, action, ambitions, you know, that gung-ho, always on the move, on the go kind of personality. You know, that's all the guna of rajas. And tamas is the guna which induces dullness, induces negative thoughts and actions, things like just sitting on the... You know, being a couch potato, for example, is one of the aspects of that. You sit there with a glass of beer, bag full of potato chips, and then you're watching football and doing nothing else. You know, that's tamas, okay? Or having some real strong negative tendencies, like having the urge to murder somebody or kill somebody. Those are the kind of things that usually go with tamas. Okay, sleeping, you know, is a part of tamas, of course. All these are necessary, so don't, you know, get this wrong then. All these are necessary, it's just which one you want to have dominance of at any given time. That will determine what your personality is eventually like. So because of this constant conflict between or among these gunas, what it's saying is that there is never that sense of peace within us. So we're always agitated, always in a sense of... And eventually all agitation of the mind leads to suffering of some kind, pain of some kind, eventually. So a person, he says, a person who is of discrimination, that means the one person who really understands everything nicely and in depth, for him, everything is painful. Because these gunas will never stop working, they will never stop doing things that they want to do, and that means there is constant agitation, constant churning of the thought processes in the mind, and eventually all this will lead to some kind of pain or suffering. Okay? So that's this sutra is all about parinam tapa sanskara dukkhaihi. So we're doing number 22 in chapter 2. Okay. I did not, my laptop stopped working, so I am without one now. Okay, so that's, you know, the essence of this sutra. Does that make sense? Does that make sense now, somewhat?
Yes. Yes.
Susan, you're okay? Yeah.
What this sounds like to me is similar to the Buddhist teaching that suffering is resistance to what is.
Yeah.
Like it's not the thing itself. I mean, you can have anything.
Mm-hmm.
Hunger, sleepiness, happiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But when we resist what is.
Yes.
That's what causes us to suffer.
That's exactly what it is. Because what makes us resist is this change in the gunas, because that keeps changing things. So we don't like to have changes, but these gunas keep changing. So therefore we resist, and that resistance causes more suffering in us. It's very true. Okay, so can we move on to number... What we did was, you know, we finished up to 22, the previous session. And now we are just reviewing from 15 onwards, just to get a good feel for it. So I just read 15. So now we'll move on to 16. So 16, the Sanskrit is Heyam Dukkham Anagatam. It's very simple. All right. What that means is that Dukkham means suffering. Anagatam means something that has yet to come or something that is going to happen in the future. And Heyam means it is preventable, avoidable. It is something that we can take care of now. So if a suffering has not yet come, we don't have to wait for it. It can be removed. The suffering that already has come and we are going through it, we probably have to live through it or do something about it. But if there is something that might happen in the future, which you can always imagine happening, you know, we are always very good at imagining suffering in the future, all of us are. But that can be avoided completely. Okay. Okay, so that's this sutra. Again, same thing, Susan, that you said, it's a Buddhist concept. Some of these are exactly the same as Buddhist concepts. Okay, there is suffering. Buddhists say there is suffering, there is a reason for suffering, and suffering is avoidable, preventable, and these are the ways to do that. So they have an eightfold path, we have an eightfold path. The items are different, right? Buddhists also have an eightfold path. Are you familiar with that?
I couldn't recite them, but yes.
Yeah, so it's the same thing. Uh-huh. But the concepts are the same. Some of the terms used are identical by Patanjali and Buddha's Buddhist teaching. Suffering is there, it's preventable, there's a reason for it, and these are the reasons, and this is how you can get rid of it. All that is there. So, Heyam Dukkham Anagatam. And the reason for that suffering is in number 17. Drashtra Drishyoho Sanyogaha Heya Hetuhu. Okay. Hetu means the reason. Heya means what is something that is preventable. So the reason for what is preventable or the reason for that suffering is the union of the seen and the seer. Okay, now this is really the crux of the Sankhya philosophy, because what it says is there are these two entities called the Purusha and Prakriti. Okay, so let me see if I can write something down.
So we think we're the sufferer. We think we're the sufferer.
Yes.
But we're really not. It's just going through us.
In some sense, yes, you're right. Okay, so let me just write this down. The two entities are Purusha and number two, Prakriti. Now this is the sort of the pure, you can call it the pure soul. And this is the matter, so to say. Hello.
Hi.
What's your name?
Barbara.
Barbara, you haven't been here before, right?
No. Okay. And your email said that this would be in 104.
104?
Hitless Suite 104.
Yeah. But why did I say that?
It's always here.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Welcome.
So you've been waiting there?
Yeah.
I'm so
Nobody
sorry.
Nobody else was there, right?
No, obviously.
No, but there was a sign that said, please ring the bell.
So, oh, man.
Oh.
I'm so sorry, Barbara. This is unfortunate. Because I don't know why. And nobody pointed that out to me.
Because they all know it's here.
Hmm?
I didn't pay attention.
Because we all know it's here.
I'm so sorry. You can just...
I did the same thing when I first came out. But then I realized you were over here. Because I've been here before.
Oh, the email always says one?
Yeah.
Oh, the email's been wrong all along?
Yeah.
Oh.
Always?
Well, I don't know always, but...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't changed the email.
Yeah.
I haven't changed the email in a long time.
Oh, well.
I guess you've got to change it.
I have to. Now it will be changed. Thanks to Barbara.
Yes. See, you served a useful purpose today in pointing that out.
Okay, so now there is this Purusha, which is the pure soul, and there is the Prakriti, which is all matter. You want to move here? That might be easier. Okay, so what do we mean by matter?
Form, the physical.
Everything in the material universe.
Yeah. Everything. Everything in the material universe, which includes my body, my mind, my intellect, everything is matter, pure matter. Everything that's non-conscious, we call it matter. Okay? The only thing that's conscious is this pure soul, that's Purusha, that's the only thing conscious. Even my intellect is non-conscious, it's not conscious of its own. It has a borrowed consciousness from the Purusha. So it's called, in the Yoga Sutra, they call it the reflected consciousness. Okay, so it's a reflected consciousness of this that makes this function.
Do we have that consciousness inside us?
We are the consciousness. So, you know, in what this, what the way they explain that is, instead of looking at it this way, that we have this body and we have a consciousness inside us. And we like to say we are the body, but there is consciousness inside us. Let's turn these things around. We are the consciousness. I am the pure consciousness, but I have a body to enclose it. Look at it this way. Okay? Instead of saying that I am the body and I have pure consciousness inside us, it's, let's turn it around in terms of realizing it. Because I am the pure consciousness, but I have an enclosure. Why do I have the enclosure? It's in one of the sutras. It says, to give us an experience of this universe. I have the enclosure.
Could you explain the reflection again? Because I've read it several times. I get confused on it. That is it?
It's
one thing reflects off the other and it gets confused.
It is confusing if you start analyzing it in depth. All you want to say is, in my mind, the way I understand it, it's just borrowed consciousness, basically. The people use the term reflection.
The whole metaphor of the mirror and everything.
Yeah, mirror and all that. So it gets confusing to me also. So for me, it's purely, I need to be in close proximity with the Purusha and then borrow that consciousness for my functioning. That's it. You can call it reflected or you can call it borrowed. I like it, borrowed consciousness.
I needed a diagram, you know.
I know.
Schematic. Show me how this works.
So, let's see if I can put together a diagram.
Well, I didn't mean to do one.
But now that you brought it up, why not? We give it a try. See if it makes sense. Okay, so let's start with the five senses. All right. So I have these five senses. Sense of, let me just call it touch, smell, taste, hearing, and what's the fifth one?
Sight.
All right, now I have the five senses, and they are impinging on my five sense organs. Okay, so I have the skin, I have the nose, I have the tongue. And I have the ear and the eyes. Right now, these are the external five sense organs, and then these are the five senses attached to them. And these are coming from the outside world. And then behind all this is we call it the mind. which is going to get the first glimpse of the input that we receive from the five senses. Okay? All right. So the mind is going to get the input initially through the five senses. And of course, the mind also has the ability to do the motor action through the arms and legs and all that. So mind is also responsible for the motor action, so to say. That's the other part. So there is input coming in, there is output going out. All right. Now, behind the mind, when I say behind, it is just a matter of, just for the purpose of understanding, we have what we call the intellect. Then there is the ego. And then there is the memory. This is a huge bank of memory. Everything that is always, that has ever happened in our life, this life as well as multitude of previous lives, everything is stored in here.
How come we don't remember what we did in the last life?
How come we don't remember? Would you like to?
Yeah.
Oh, you'll be in trouble. Well, I have trouble remembering what I have in this life.
Yeah, well, I know, but
I'm in trouble in the sense, I am in trouble if I remember too much from this life. The idea is to start forgetting all these things. It's a gift that we don't remember all that, but some people do. Some people have the gift of remembering past lives. And Patanjali says that you can actually, in your deep state of meditation, you can recall your past life. That's what Patanjali says, and we read that in chapter 3. Right? So you can get access to your past lives and also your future. That's a part of the siddhis or the super normal powers that yoga can give people. Okay? So this is the memory, but this stuff in the here, how it comes up, based on the input, based on the trigger that we receive at every moment in life, some of that stuff comes up, and some of it based on what we did last life. It happens. Okay? So it comes up based on the trigger. Yeah. Consciously, you may not be able to remember, pull stuff out from the last life, but it comes up. Okay? So intellect can access this memory, ego can access this memory. All right? All right, and now, beyond all that, there is a soft wall here, and then here is the Purusha, or the, so to say, soul, or the Atma, or spirit, or the sense of being, etc., etc. Now, the way the whole thing functions is that, remember, the mind gets the input from the five senses, and to make a decision, it needs to pass it on to the intellect. Intellect is a slave of the ego, so it transfers the request to the ego, and ego, based on the memory, will guide us as to what the next action should be based on the input. Okay? Unfortunately, the ego always likes to pull up stuff which either has a like or a dislike. Only then it makes a decision. If I drank a cup of coffee or had a piece of cake last time and it liked it, ego would like to repeat that. Whether or not it's good for us, that's what ego likes to do. It always likes to look at the labels, and if it's good, I'd like to repeat it. If it was bad, it likes to avoid it. That's just the way things are right now. Okay? But that's what causes all the problems, because we are absolutely not able to make a decision based on pure input. We don't see things as they are because we like to color it based on what we experienced in the past, and with that coloration, we get into trouble all the time. So that's how the mind functions now. The combination of these four is what we call the mind stuff. Some people call it the mind, mind function, whatever. In some books it's called mind complex.
Mind field,
whatever. So, the over big mind, so to say. And then there is this whole concept of this Purusha attaching itself to this complex and thinking that it is not independent. So the ego becomes very, very egoistic, right? It says, I am everything. I don't know who this person is, but I control this life, therefore I am the boss. And because this Purusha is so muddled up, so confused and ignorant in a sense, it's not given the opportunity, we are always in a mess. That's the whole purpose of this discussion. Normally what it says is this should be purely an observer. That's the word they used in that sutra that we just read, observer, seer. Okay, so this is the seer or the observer, and this part is the seen or the observed. And it is the collusion of the two that is the cause of that suffering that it is talking about. That's the sutra that we just read. Okay? Drashtra drishyoho sanyogaha. Sanyogaha means the collusion of the two, the combination, the joining of the two is the heya hetuhu. Heya was the reason for suffering, and hetu is the cause. So the cause of that suffering which needs to be avoided, which can be avoided, is this collusion between these two, is the connection, this unfortunate connection between these two. And that's what makes us suffer.
So when we think that we are all of this, and when we identify ourselves, self, with all of this, that is suffering.
That is suffering. That causes suffering, yes. It's the identification with my mind-body complex, and then we allow the ego to dominate the whole decision-making process, then we suffer. Because ego likes to use those labels, with labels which it has itself labeled in the past, good, bad, ugly, handsome, okay, like it, dislike it, love it, hate it, all those labels that ego has put in the first place, and it loves those labels. And every decision it makes is based on those labels. Nothing is based on pure being as it is. Right?
So is the ideal for us, for these senses, to connect to the Purusha and to bypass the ego?
We're not connecting with the Purusha at all. We're not connecting with the Purusha. What we're doing is, we are building our understanding to the level where we know that all these decisions eventually should be made by the intellect. Every action, every decision, every thing that we do or think or feel in life should be based on the intellect, which is being driven by the pure light coming from the Purusha, not by the light thrown by the ego. Okay? If we can get to that point, which is the goal of yoga, then we will not be suffering. Then we realize that we are getting this bright light coming from the pure Purusha, which is doing nothing. It's just being an observer. Now it has lost its identification with the ego. And when it does that, then we are fat, dumb, and happy. Nothing to worry about then. So that's the whole purpose of this whole yoga understanding. So I'm not a good diagram maker, but I I hope it works. Okay. And then, of course, as I said, you know, there are, we always should keep in mind that we have these 23 elements so that, you know, we understand what our, you know, constituent items are. So remember, these are the five senses, right? Then the whole physical structure is a composite of five elements, as they are called, which is the earth, water, fire, air, and ether or space. Okay, so these are the five, they are called gross elements, you can call them. So the five of these, that makes it 15, right? Yeah. And then the five organs of action, like I said, the mind is going to do the motor action through those five organs of action, which are, so the action organs are, what are these five? Speaking, that's tongue.
Tongue, locomotion.
Tongue and locomotion.
Procreation.
Number.
Elimination.
Procreation. Elimination. And?
Seeing?
No, just hands and arms.
Hands and arms.
So,
grabbing things,
hands, arms, etc. So these are the five organs of action. Okay, so these are the five here. So that makes us 20. And then mind, intellect, and ego, that makes it 23. Memory in this discussion is a part of the, it's either connected with this or this or combination of it. It's never listed separately. But in this list of the Sankhya, whereas in the discussion on the mind, this is always listed separately. All right. So this is a kind of a bird's eye view of how the mind is depicted to function. All right. This is all based on the Sankhya philosophy. Okay. So that's why this sutra was that drashtra drishyoho sanyoga. Now, drashtra was the seer. That's the word drashtra.
See.
We were on 17. So drashtra was the seer, and drishya is the seen. That's the Sanskrit word for seen, one that is being observed. That's drishya. And it's the union of the two, it's the collusion of the two, it's the apparent joining of the two that is causing us this suffering. Heya hetuhu, that means that's the reason for this suffering that we are going through. You know, when we talk of yoga, when most people, especially yoga teachers, you know, they are fond of doing this. When they talk of yoga and people ask them, what's yoga? It's the union. Yoga means the union. Union of what? Mind, body, and soul. You probably have heard that statement. Anybody? Most people tend to do that. Mindlessly, blindly, I mean, this is what they have heard and this is what they say. What is yoga? Yoga is the union. Union of what? Mind, body, and soul. What does it mean? I don't know. That's what the book says. That's it. I mean, they don't go beyond that because they don't have a better understanding of what that statement is supposed to mean. But what does Patanjali say? That's the entire cause of this whole suffering that we're going through. It's the union of this mind, body, and soul. Union of mind, body, and soul is suffering. That's what we just said. That's Sankhya philosophy. Does everyone get that?
So you don't want to be, you don't want to have the union between all of these. You
want we don't want this union. We just said that. Between the seer and the seen. We want to look at seer as being a totally independent, separate entity, which is uncluttered by any influence from the ego or the intellect. It is all it is doing is providing its own brilliance so that the intellect can work independently, beautifully, without any clutter. We need that. We need the, let's not call it the union, we need the closeness of the two, proximity of the two. We need that. It's only because of that. In fact, there is a sutra coming up, so it gets a little confusing. We need the closeness of the two for this whole thing to function, otherwise it won't function. But we don't need that superimposition of this on this. It's the superimposition that we are avoiding. We don't want to forget about it now. We want the closeness, the proximity, otherwise it won't function. Okay? So a few sutras later, you know, you will see it gets a little more confusing. We'll talk about that.
When you say you don't want the superimposition of the Purusha on the ego, or did you mean the ego over the Purusha?
Purusha over the ego.
Purusha over the ego.
So ego should not think that I am the controller of everything. Ego should not think that.
Okay.
All right?
So you don't want the ego over the Purusha.
Right.
Yes. Hi. All right. So that's sutra number 17. Then 18 is, let's read that. We went through all this, that's why I'm kind of going through it one more time. So let me read the Sanskrit first, and then we will read the English translation. So prakash kriya sthiti shilam bhutendriyatmakam bhogapavargartham drishyam. That's the Sanskrit part. Okay. And Gail, you want to read this, the English translation?
The seen is the nature of the gunas, illumination, activity, and inertia, and consists of the elements and the senses, whose purpose is to provide both experiences and liberation to the Purusha.
Right. So that is this sutra now, which is telling us the purpose of all this, you know, like Kalpana, you said, should we look at it, you know, we have the Atma inside us, or which way? So think of it as the Atma, we are the Atma, we are the soul, we are the Purusha, and we do have this enclosure around us, which we call this mind-body complex. And what's the purpose of this mind-body complex? That's the sutra now. Okay, so what it's saying is, this entire mind-body complex, so to say, or this matter part, or the prakriti part, it's stating the same thing one more time. It is the composite of these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Let's memorize these, you know, otherwise it won't work. Okay, so repeat after me. Sattva, Rajas, Tamas. Sattva is the element of purity, brightness, illumination. That's what it is called here. Prakash. Prakash means illumination, representing sattva. Okay? Kriya is the activity, action. That's Rajas. That's called Rajas in Sanskrit. So sattva, rajas. Rajas is activity, action. Like I said, ambition, determination to be the president of this company. And all that is part of rajas. And then tamas is sthiti. That means inertia, stability. You don't want to move. You just want to sit there and that's it. You know, like I said, just eat a bowl full of potato chips and do nothing else. That's sthiti. Sthiti means stability or desire to have no movement. Okay? So I call it the couch potato-ness. All right. So, prakash, kriya, and sthiti, these are the three gunas, which are the composite of all this entire prakriti, this element, this matter, nature, so to say. And the purpose of this whole thing is twofold. Okay. One is, the Sanskrit term he uses, bhoga. That's the term Patanjali uses, bhoga. Bhoga means experience.
Experience.
Bhoga is the life's experiences. What are we going through in life? That's called bhoga. And apavarga is the second term he uses. Apavarga means deliverance, liberation, you know. Delivery from your whole chain of suffering, or liberation, so to say. It's the word Patanjali uses, apavarga. So bhoga and apavarga are the two. Bhoga is experience. And experience could be positive, negative, neutral, any kind of experience, right? Could be anything. Based on our actions, based on our past karmas. And this whole concept of karma we discussed in the previous 6 or 7 sutras. So this karma theory was a part of the background that we just went through. That based on our karmas, we will reap the effects or the results of our karmas, whether in this life or in a subsequent life. All that we covered in the last few sutras just before this. But we will experience life in multitude of ways, good, bad, not so good, not so bad, but all shades of experiences. And the ego will always put a label on it. It loves to do that. Good experience, bad experience, lovely, hateful, all that stuff. Okay? And then the whole cycle continues because the ego doesn't want to give up, and this cycle continues. Okay? The cycle stops only when the ego is not playing a role. It's when the intellect becomes sharp enough, when the intellect becomes strong enough that it does not allow the ego to interfere in its activities, that's deliverance, that liberation eventually. Okay. But it is the role of this drishya, of this whole matter, of this whole prakriti, is to provide these twofold jobs, two things, bhoga and apavarga. Okay. Now, commentators have had, you know, a little difference of opinion in terms of, you know, what is the exact interpretation of this sutra. Some say that it is a sequence. You have to go through bhoga first and then only apavarga comes. Some say they're totally independent of each other. Because the Sanskrit language, sometimes you can interpret in your own ways. There are some ways you can think of it, you know, this way or that way. Okay? But, you know, from my perspective, it doesn't matter. You know, just think of it that it is, both have to happen. You have to have life experiences, and also it eventually going to lead us to the whole this role of liberation, deliverance. And you do that by creating these experiences which are more and more pure without those labels. Okay? So when we start putting these experiences down in our memory without those labels. So, if I'm going through this meeting, right, what I want to do eventually is to put a label, put this whole thing in my memory as it's being on a Saturday, on such and such date, with, you know, 5 or 6 people present in the class, with Subhash having no laptop, etc., etc., right? Without putting a label on it, I loved it. I hated it. This was the most useless waste of time. You know, all those things. You understand? That's getting the ego involved. So as long as we don't put those labels, but just record the exact pure I mean, how as pure as it can be, incidents in our memory, we are good to go.
Basically, make it uneventful and not. But then, how will you proceed with life if you can't put a label and say, "I'd like to do this"?
Okay, that's a very good point. No, the label can be put by the ego or the intellect. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is let the intellect put a label. Intellect will say that it was a pleasant experience, but not from the point of the view of the ego, that I must have it again, otherwise I'm going to die, otherwise I'm going to be miserable if I don't have that. Intellect would say it was a likable experience. It's like, you know, a child having to touch a hot element. It has to have that experience before it knows not to touch it again. Right? Same thing. We are also doing the same thing here. So the intellect puts the label so that when it happens next time, it knows what to do or how to handle the situation. Not based on the ego. Ego will say, you know, I look at a person, oh, this person looks like the other person. Okay, and that memory, in my memory, that other person was a terrible man, you know. I had the worst experience with that person, and because this person looks like him, therefore he must be the same. That's what the ego does. Okay, but we want to be able to very intellect, at the level of the intellect, make those decisions, not at the level of the ego. Then we are good to go. Okay, so that's the this current sutra, which is to understand that this is all about gaining bhoga and apavarga. Bhoga is the life's experiences, apavarga is the liberation. And how does it do it? Through this bhuta and indriya. So bhuta is the five elements. All the elements are called bhuta. That's what we call this. And indriya are these senses. And the word bhutendriya here is actually, according to the commentators, it's meant to include these 23 elements, basically, everything. It's just using those terms, bhutendriya, okay? But it's in essence, it means this entire complex of 23 elements, which we just talked about. So these 23 elements are used to eventually provide that whole sense of liberation. But in between, we need the life's experiences also. Bhoga. Okay. Let's move on to next number, 19. Okay. Vishesha Vishesha Linga Matra Alingani Guna Parvani. That's the Sanskrit phrase. Okay, so Barbara, you want to read the English translation?
No, I don't think I have the same book.
It's the same book. You all have the same book. It's interesting, but everyone seems to have the same book. Yeah, stages of the gunas, yeah.
Are specific, non-specific, defined, and undefinable.
Okay. This, you know, we went through this last time. Not going to spend too much time, otherwise we'll get stuck on this one. But this has to do with the concept of a cause and a result, cause and effect. Okay, so the more grosser the object is, the less chance it has to have an effect. Okay, or to be a cause of something else. For example, these five elements, they are at the grossest level. They cannot cause anything else to be affected. They are the effect of something else. The cause, they have a cause inherent in them. All right. So So these become vishesha, or the specific ones. Non-specific are these senses, because the senses cause these five elements to manifest, etc., etc. So more subtler you go, right, the more potent you are in terms of having an effect in you. Okay? So, and then what it says, alingani, the subtlest of all this, at the level of these 23, among them, the subtlest is the intellect. That's what it says. The subtlest of these 23 is the intellect. That's the root cause of all the other effects that are following it. So the mind is a... So, for example, intellect causes the ego to function, and then ego brings about all the other things slowly. This is something that has been explained in the Sankhya philosophy. I have not seen a very... So it is a very, at my level, I have not seen an explanation which is understandable at my level, so to say. I'm sure other people understand it. I don't. I don't understand how this whole sequence is explained. That intellect is the cause for the ego. Ego is the cause for all the five senses. And five senses are the cause for all these five elements. How that happens, I don't know. But that's what the Sankhya philosophy says. If you guys come up with some better explanation, please do share. I don't. I've tried to find from many books, but haven't yet figured out what that means. So just leave it at that. Okay? Now, before this whole thing comes about, there is this most subtle, or the subtlest of all these subtle, is the mula prakriti, or the root prakriti level, which is the unmanifest state of prakriti, where the gunas are all in a state of balance. So the sattva, rajas and tamas are in a state of balance. When that happens, then there is no manifestation. Okay? Nothing can come about. It's only when there is an imbalance among these three gunas that the manifestation of these 23 elements can happen. Okay? So that's called the pure prakriti, as it's called. Pure prakriti.
Is that in the sense of our individual selves, or is it in the sense of universal?
It has both complements. Both the elements are there. There's individual, and there's the cosmic element
so
also.
So they're all imbalanced.
Yes. Yes. So there's a cosmic counterpart, and there's an individual counterpart. Okay. In the yoga or the Sankhya concept, they limit the discussion to the individual. When you go to, for example, Vedanta, etc. Okay. For example, if you read this text called the Mandukya Upanishad. Anybody heard that term? Mandukya Upanishad. Okay. It talks about both. It talks about the individual as well as the cosmic counterpart. Anybody remember Mandukya? Nobody has read that. You've read it?
I don't understand it, but I read it.
Okay. So it's all about, for example, that, since I mentioned it, it's all about Om. Okay, it's all about Om, and Om as a composite of three letters, A, U, and M. Okay, and then A has its own characteristics, U has its own, and M has it. A is the waking state, U is the dream state, and M is the deep sleep state. The reason I'm mentioning all this is because since you mentioned counterpart, the cosmic, yes, it does have cosmic counterpart. It's just that. Sankhya and Yoga, they don't want to discuss all that.
What's the name of that book on Om? What's the name of the book on Om?
Mandukya. Mandukya. Mandukya Upanishad. 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 It's one of the 11 major Upanishads. There are 11 major Upanishads. There are 108 in total. And this is one of the major 11. And this is fully dedicated to the description of the Om symbol. And then it talks about the, you know, the three letters A, U, and M as having both an individual interpretation as well as the cosmic level. Okay. But that's a text. If you really want to understand, like Laura said, she read it, but you'll need a real teacher, a real teacher, to understand that text. It is so deep. So you'll need to go to somebody who really understands it. At one time I thought I found one when I was in Rishikesh, but even he kind of fizzled out. I didn't. I'm still waiting for that. Where the guy who can explain it to me? But like I said, I was in Rishikesh doing that course at that ashram, and this one person I thought was very knowledgeable, and I started, you know, enjoying sitting down with him. But when I talked about this Mandukya Upanishad, he fizzled out also. Anyway, still waiting. Okay, so this is the sutra number, what was that, number 20? No, 19. So all it says is that these three gunas, they go through these stages of being specific, non-specific, and then without any lingas or any symbol. And eventually, it's the pure prakriti which has no symbol, which has no, you know, nothing to describe it, basically. Okay. And then the next is drashta drishimatra shuddhopi pratyaya anupashyaha. So what that means is, let me just fix. Dave, you want to read that meaning?
Sure. The seer is nothing but the power of seeing, which, although pure, appears to see through the mind.
The seer is nothing but the power of seeing? Yeah. So it's drashta. That means what it's saying is that, again, because of this confusion, because of the superimposition, this seer, okay, it is seeing itself almost like through the eyes of the ego. Okay. Even though it's pure, even though by itself it's pure and it is supposed to be pure and completely untouched by anything else. It's just supposed to be a pure seer. But because of its superimposition by the on the ego, it doesn't know what it is. It doesn't know its own purity. That's what the sutra means. That it's confused. In a sense, we are confused because we are nothing but this whole conglomeration. And it's confusion compounded because we do not know our true identity. And because of the superimposition, we don't know. We are not just the pure seer, but we are all this mess up. That's what this sutra says, simplistically. All right? Even though it's supposed to be pure, it's not because of its superimposition. Okay? And then the next one is Tadartha eva drishyasya atma. So, again, coming out of the same concept, drishya means the seer, the seen, drishya, seen, what is being observed. The purpose of the drishya is nothing to serve the purpose of the pure soul. That was just a repetition of the previous sutra, bhoga and apavarga. Experience and liberation are the two purposes for which it exists. So even though this has the superimposition on this scene, the purpose of the scene is still only to serve the purpose of its master, Purusha. That's all. So all gets very heavy, like I said, you know. It's Sankhya and in its depth.
So just out of talking about one of the other ones that you talk about, so you're saying that the scene exists only for the seer's purpose?
Yes.
Yet you don't want the scene and the seer to be together?
Together, yes.
Because if they are?
They have, okay, because eventually you want their independence, eventually. Closeness, but independence. They want to be in close proximity, but independent, eventually. But we're coming to that next sutra, you know, which says that there is some requirement that they work together, because otherwise we will not understand what's going on. So that collusion is required for us to understand the whole concept. Okay? So...
question. So when you have that closeness, but not the...
collusion. Not the togetherness.
Not togetherness. Is that the state of samadhi?
Yes.
Oh, it is.
Okay. Yes, it is the highest state of samadhi, which Patanjali calls kaivalya. It's beyond the practical stage of samadhi, because practical stage of samadhi is the eight limbs of yoga. Mm-hmm. They are needed as practice, and samadhi is one of those practices, eight limbs of yoga, to get to the state of kaivalya, okay, which is the understanding of the eventual state of total independence.
And in Buddhism, we call that enlightenment.
Yes, it's the same thing.
Okay.
Self-realization, enlightenment, they are identical terms. Yes. Absolutely, yes. Okay. When you, enlightenment means what? We are able to see the pure light of Purusha for our function. Pure light. And now I have the light of this Purusha, and I'm able to function based on that light. That's enlightenment. You know, I get enlightened because of that light. Very similar, you know, it's not too different actually. See? So what number was that? 21. And then we also did 22 last time, which is Kritartham prati nashtam api nashtam tadanya sadharanatvat. So here, you know, this whole, again, this concept of Sankhya, right? What Sankhya says that every living being is a soul by itself, is a Purusha by itself. Okay. Now this concept is very different from Vedanta and all that. Okay. In Vedanta there is only one soul. In Sankhya there is multitude of souls. Multitude. Every living entity is its own pure soul. That's it. Okay. But Prakriti is common. Everybody has the same prakriti, everyone has the same 23 elements, etc., etc. Alright? So what this sutra is saying, that for one who has attained that sense of enlightenment, right? Oh, let's read the English translation.
Although destroyed for one who has attained liberation, it, the scene, still exists for others, being common to them.
So that's what I was coming to. You know, what it means is that for someone who has gained enlightenment, right, this scene, this whole complex, is now back to its unmanifest state with the three gunas being perfectly balanced. That means this whole complex of 23 elements has no meaning now. For the person who has completely gained enlightenment. I don't know if it makes sense or not, but it's a very difficult concept. You know, I'm not sure. I understand it 100%, but this is what it is. The reason I say that is because you will probably need to be there fully enlightened book to understand it thoroughly.
I guess what it means is none of this matters anymore.
Exactly. That's
it
very true.
It doesn't go away because it's still there for others.
Yeah, the others are still in the midst of it.
The others who are still confused about all this, this is all functioning at the 23 element level. Mm-hmm. But for one who has attained enlightenment, it means nothing. You know, there is no more ego functioning. There is no more all the lows and highs of life, good and bad, nothing of that. And I'm able to live a very pure, happy life, pure life. That means not cluttered by anything that the ego puts a label on. I know exactly what to do at a given time, and my intellect does everything at that point. Because the gunas are balanced now. The gunas are not playing that game that they always like to do. But the prakriti remains the same for everyone else, because those who are not enlightened. Okay?
And we still have to function in that game, because here.
Exactly. Yeah, we're still functioning. As long as we can function without the negative influence of the ego, we are good to go. Right? So, this was number 21? 22. Oh, this is how much we did the previous time. Okay. Now, this 23, right, is the one which is very confusing to me, or it has been very confusing for a long time. Because now it's saying that to understand, oh, let me read the Sanskrit first. I get carried over, okay. Swaswami shaktyoho swarupopalabdhi hetuhu sanyogaha. And Kalpana, you want to read the Sanskrit meaning? The English meaning?
Yeah. The union of the owner, Purusha, and owned Prakriti causes the recognition of the nature and powers of them both.
Okay. So here it says union is required. Even though the ultimate goal is to get rid of that union, it is required. Why is it required? It's only through that union and only through that experience, etc., that bhoga that we do we realize the real importance of both. Okay? Eventually, having realized all that, we want to get rid of that union. That's the whole purpose of this. Right? But at some point, we need that union so we understand what the purpose is, what the purpose of prakriti is, what the purpose of purusha is. And for the longest time when we did this, you know, I could never understand you. On the one hand, you're saying we don't want union, and on the other hand, now you're saying you need the union. What's going on? But it's a sequential thing, you can say. You know, it's a sequential thing. You have to have the union initially so that you can understand how they interact with each other and what the isolation point is eventually. Yes,
is the
heart of it and the hard part, okay? Because we have to understand what it is saying is actually it says the concept here is the owner and the own. Swa and Swami. Swami is one who owns something. That's the Swami. The Sanskrit term, probably you've heard that term, Swami. Okay, and so there is an owner and there is something that's owned. So in this context, what he's saying is this Purusha is the owner and it owns all this. And there, it's like a server, so to say. You know, so this guy is the owner and this whole thing is the servant in a sense, right? Because it has a purpose, and the purpose is to fulfill the objective of this Purusha. And the objective is to eventually feel that liberation, isolation, non-union. But that happens only through union. that's where it was very...
achieve non-union through union.
Yes. This was the most, you know, challenging
that's
part.
Koan. Hmm? That's like a Buddhist koan.
What
is
that?
Non-union through union. Yeah.
But that's what it is. Union through non-union through union. Like they say, you have the mind to understand how to go past the mind.
Is it also necessary, the union, to exist in the physical world? I would think it would be, right?
Yeah. So it's at all levels.
You still have that after non-union. You're still in a physical universe. Mm-hmm. These two aren't so conjoined. You're not experiencing through ego anymore. Is that
right?
What he's trying to say?
Yes. Yes. May he's not happy.
I'm just thinking. I just felt like in southern India, right, we think about this union of these two energies, Shiva and Shakti together.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, so that's a concept from the ancient, the system, so to say. It's all from Kundalini aspect of yoga. There is a Shiva residing here, Shakti residing at the base of the spine. That's in the Kundalini thing. Okay. This whole science of Tantra is separate from the science of yoga, in a sense. In fact, it is more ancient compared to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. But Patanjali did not use any of the concepts from Tantra into his Yoga Sutras. It's not too different, actually. Okay. You can think of Shiva and Shakti as being Purusha and Prakriti. Very similar in concept. Okay. But eventually, they have to be separated. Even though, again, very similar concept, it's the union of the two. Okay. Now, since she mentioned that, I must mention that Shiva, does anyone know, everyone know what Shiva we're talking about now? Shiva, then let's not get that discussion. It's not going to be meaningful. Nobody understands that. Okay, otherwise it gets more confusing. But just to complete your discussion, this point, Shiva is always represented as Ardhanarishvara, which means he's half male and half female. He's half Purusha and half Prakriti. He's half Shiva and half Shakti. He's always depicted as Ardhanarishvara. You have heard the term? Right, half man and half woman. Why? For that same reason. You need the initial union to understand this separation eventually. Eventually you want to have completely a separate Shiva and Shakti. But initially that Ardhanarishvara concept is required. Not very different. Very similar concepts. Okay, so through this union you will understand the disunion or the total independence or the kaivalya. Kaivalya means pure independence eventually. Isolation of the two concepts. Okay, so that is this sutra number 23. That we need that union to understand their respective powers and their existence and then go on from that point on.
But to me it almost seems like ego seems to be the only negative aspect about this.
The whole thing,
If not, it would have been fine to have the union and continue moving on.
Yes, yes, yes.
So just get rid of ego,
That's exactly the whole point. Okay. That the whole purpose of yoga is to eliminate the negative influence of ego. Put it in its place. Let it do what it's supposed to do and nothing beyond that.
But not so easily done.
Not so easily done.
Well, it has a purpose too, the I sense.
See, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Put it in its place, let it do its function. Its function is identification of what's supposed to be done. What's my role at a given time? For example, again, these are just the way things are explained. Ego is the one which will tell you at this moment, I am the mother, I am the worker, I am the principal, I am the teacher. But then immediately after having identified the role, transfer the power to the intellect. Let the intellect decide what it wants to do. But in the current state of affairs, it keeps that power. My role is the mother. And because I'm the mother, I know that this child's room should be very clean. And therefore, I have the right to shout at my child. You stupid fellow, I told you to clean this room. That's where the problem comes. You get the idea? It has a role to play, but only that much. Nothing beyond that. Okay? So the 23 said that that union is required, but then that union is the result of avidya. So tasya hetur avidya. And the English translation is simple. The cause of this union is ignorance. So all that is required.
Confusing because you're supposed to have it, but then
yeah, but we are eventually supposed to get rid of ignorance. That's what I'm saying. This will need a lot of reflection, a lot of understanding, maybe reading commentary by at least 4 or 5 different commentators, and then just meditating on this concept for a long time. Then you might be able to understand it. It's confusing. I'm not going to deny that. I have been confused with this concept for a long time. I think I'm beginning to get some sense of it now, but I don't think I can explain that very well yet.
Explain it very well today.
Well, I mean, still, I still have doubts in my mind. Okay, what's avidya? Avidya is ignorance. Remember, in the very beginning of chapter 2, there were 5 kleshas mentioned. Klesha are the reason or the causes of suffering. Does anybody remember those 5 kleshas? Yeah. Avidya was the number 1, the first one out of those. Avidya. So let me just very quickly go over those 5 kleshas. Avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, and abhinavesha. Very good. You remember that. That's good. Okay, so avidya is ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of not knowing who I am. Ignorance of not knowing my true identity. And that leads to the power of ego being amplified. Because I am not aware of who I am, therefore ego takes over. Asmita, that's the second term. Asmita means the ego, asmita, Sanskrit term. I keep repeating this because, you know, it is important for me to always mention the Sanskrit words here. For me, it is very important, okay? Because that's what makes me understand what they are, all right? And then, of course, I always like to give the translation. So asmita is the ego part. That stems from the fact that I'm ignorant. The ego takes over. And when the ego takes over, it gives rise to those labels, like and dislike. That's raga and dvesha. Raga is likes, dvesha is dislikes. And when I have these likes and dislikes, I have all kinds of fears in my life. If I like something, I'm afraid that I might lose it or I might not be able to get it. If I dislike something, I'm afraid that I might not be able to get rid of it. Right? That's fear. And the ultimate fear, I might lose my life. That's the ultimate fear. Fear of death. That's called abhinivesha. So these are the 5 causes of suffering called klesha in Sanskrit. And avidya is the number 1, the mother of all. It's the root cause of all suffering. Is not knowing who I am. And that is the cause of this union between the Purusha and Prakriti that we have been talking about. Okay? So, tasya hetu ravidya means, tasya means, hetu means the reason. So, reason for this whole complex stuff that we talked about is avidya, ignorance. Okay? That is the next sutra. And then we come to number 25. Okay? tadabhavat sanyoga bhavaha hanam tad drishehe kaivalyam. So we finally reach the state of kaivalyam. Okay, so anybody want to read the translation?
I can read.
Yeah, go ahead, Bahi.
Without this ignorance, no such union occurs. This is the independence of the seer.
Right. So now if we do not have this avidya, if we do not have this ignorance, then my ego is unable to play a dominant role. Okay? And when my ego is unable to play a dominant role, I can see things clearly as they are. Then it is, in the computer terms, it's called WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. It's not cluttered by any color that I don't want in my life. Then I'm working through the purity of my soul and through the purity of my intellect, because now the intellect is able to use that reflection or that borrowed light for its function without having the influence from the ego. And I'm very, very content with the way things are. Right? Look at things exactly what they are, no coloration. No labeling of like, dislike, hate, love, nothing of that sort. Purely as they are. Right? And that's what the sutra is saying, that I can now function from a very pure perspective. Then when there is no ignorance, then this union doesn't happen. That means my purusha is not being superimposed on the ego. When that doesn't happen, then it is purely that independence that I'm looking for. Patanjali calls it kaivalyam. Kaivalyam is the state of being purely independent of this mind-body complex. Kaivalyam. Okay? And then I have attained the state of kaivalyam, which is exactly what I've been looking for. And I'm able to stay at a beautiful, what should I say, peaceful, calm level. Right? So, drishehe kaivalyam. Drishehe means of the seer. Kaivalyam, or the total isolation or total independence of the seer. They still remain in proximity with each other. Remember, we keep that in mind. Sankhya says they have to be in each other's proximity for life to function. But independent. Close, but independent. That's the way you want to look at this. Alright? Okay, I'm moving quickly, but let's try to do the next one. So, now the next one, it says, number 26, which says, Viveka khyatihi aviplava. Actually, in the past we have been repeating after this now. Okay, so let's all repeat this. Viveka khyatihi aviplava hanopaya. So let's do it one more time. Viveka khyatihi aviplava hanopayaha. So if I would read the whole thing in one sentence, viveka khyatir aviplava hanopayaha. Now what this means is, again you can go back to Susan for the meaning.
Uninterrupted discriminative discernment is the method for its removal.
Okay, so what are we trying to do? How do you get to that state of kaivalya? It is this term that Patanjali has used in a few other places also. He calls it viveka khyatihi. Viveka. Now viveka is a term, Sanskrit term, which you can say discriminatory wisdom. That's the way I understand that term. Discriminatory wisdom. What does that mean? What it means is that without being interrupted by the ego, I am able to discriminate purely between good and bad, between right and wrong, between what is, you know, what is and what is not, basically. I am able to do that discrimination through that pure intuitive wisdom, which is getting its light from the Purusha, not from the ego. Normally, that intuitive wisdom is hidden from us. We don't have true access to that. Why? Because ego likes to put a tight cover on that intuition. Occasionally I get a glimpse of that, occasionally. But as soon as that happens, ego goes and puts a lid back on it. Any example of that? We see that in life all the time. You know, I can think of one simple thing. You know, we're going on the road and see an accident, somebody is hurt maybe. You know, my intuitive wisdom will say, let's help this guy out, right? So we might want to stop. I may even have to cancel my appointment or wherever I'm heading because this is very important. My intuition says it's very important. Guess what the ego says? You don't want to mix up with this. You don't want to get involved. Who knows who the guy is, you know. We will make 100 different excuses so I can run away from that spot. That's ego's involvement. You get the idea? This is how our pure intuitive wisdom is always covered by the ego. Intuition will say, let's do this. Ego will say, no, forget it. Intuitive wisdom will say that at 6 o'clock, let me get up and do my yoga. Ego says, tomorrow, you know. It's so beautiful, the cover is so beautiful, warm, comfortable. We can wait for one more day. Who the hell cares, right? So this Viveka Khyati, this pure intuitive wisdom, it's called Viveka Khyati by Patanjali. So it says that it's the aviplava. Aviplava means, something that is floating around, you know, moving, shifting around. Aviplava means continuous, pure, uninterrupted flow of this pure intuitive wisdom called Viveka Khyati. When you can gain access to that pure intuition, that's the means for getting rid of this avidya. That's what it says. Okay? So we want to establish that complete connection with this uninterrupted flow of pure intuitive wisdom, discriminatory wisdom, then we can get into this avidya and we are in a shape, good to go for the state of Kaivalya. Kaivalya is that independence. Yeah.
Your example of intuitive wisdom suggests that the compassionate route would be the route of wisdom. Okay, so stopping to help someone. I understand that, but from my own life, I can look back on several incidents where I had a bad feeling about someone, just instantly. And then I tell them, no, that's being prejudiced, that's unfair. You know, like my higher intellectual self. Or you could argue that that's my ego because I want to be a good person. But I had a gut feeling, this is a bad person, like to sense evil. And I've learned that I trust my gut, even if it doesn't seem politically correct, even if it seems like I'm not being fair to that person, I'm judging them. But it's like an instant. It doesn't go through. It's not a thinking thing.
Well, see, the point is, I understand your point perfectly. In the state that we are in at this moment, we are confused between the roles of the ego and the intellect. We don't know where one steps in and the other stops. We think it's the intellect. It may not be. Who knows? We don't know. So this thought that it's the gut feeling coming from my pure intellect or from my pure intuition may be accurate, it may not be accurate. Until my whole complex is so pure that my ego, I'm able to eliminate the ego altogether, I will not know for a fact whether it was coming from this side or from that side. I don't know. It's hard to judge. It's a slow, iterative process of sharpening that, you know.
So meditate.
Keep doing that until your intellect is so sharp and pure that it knows exactly that it's not depending on the ego and it has access to that pure intuition, that pure gut feeling that I'm looking for. But that's a slow process. It takes not one lifetime, they say. Patanjali says multiple lifetimes. But it's a long process. In the meantime, our job is to still follow the gut feeling. It's perfectly okay. So that, you know, at least you're convinced in your own mind that you're following your gut feeling, intuition, and not the ego. And then keeps refining that whole process slowly over a period. It will need refinement, and it will keep getting refined the more you meditate.
I would just say a prayer and move on if I felt, you know, scared. Say a prayer for that person and just...
But you're absolutely right. You know, that's how the things will work eventually, yes.
But I think a good way of judging or trying to figure out whether it's ego or intellect related is, as you say, coloring. If there's something of I involved in that...
Perfect, yeah.
Then you know your ego is playing a role and
yes.
It's not the intellect.
Yes.
If what? You're feeling about it or something's going to happen to you or those kind of fears, then it's ego, it's not.
Sometimes it is simple, you know, if you can answer that question, what's in it for me? If that question is being asked, then it's the ego. We know that. It's very simple. You know, from what you said, what's in it for me? Then it's the ego. Simplistic way of not having the ego involved in is it the right thing to do?
Yeah, what's the right thing to do? Yeah.
Right? Rather than what's in it for me. Now, the answer may be the same, depending on who's guiding that answer. Okay? But that's the process of refinement, which will happen over a period of time. All right. So that's the sutra number. So viveka khyati aviplava. Aviplava is a nice word, I like that. It means plava is to float or to swim across something, you know. Plava is something that's floating around, moving around. Aviplava means straight through. No movement. Steadiness.
Connotation of that is.
Yes, the mind's steadiness is a good connotation because mind is agitated because of the ego. Uh-huh. And its steadiness is considered to be a good thing. And it's always, you know, in our literature, you will see that example of a lake, mm-hmm. okay, which is perfectly still.
Right.
When the lake is perfectly still, you can see the bottom mm-hmm. of the lake. Mm-hmm. That's the sense of steadiness of the mind. You can. When you can see the bottom, if the bottom is the purusha eventually. Mm-hmm. So if there is movement, if there's no steadiness, then you cannot see, then there are waves and there's dirtiness, mm-hmm. and you can't see the bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good metaphor. It's commonly used in our culture, in our literature. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's... Did you have other thoughts on that?
No, I was just trying to understand it in terms that I had heard this wisdom described in other traditions. And
come
steadiness
up, come up
is
with
the one that I thought of. Steadiness of
yeah.
mind.
Well, I thought you have some other term also that you.
No.
Okay, then that's fine then. No. Then it's the same thing, yeah. Okay. Okay, so... So that's number 26. Let's move on to 27. Any other questions before we do that? So the number 27 is Tasya Saptadha Prantabhumihi Prajna. Tasya Saptadha Prantabhumihi Prajna. Okay, so the meaning is, can you read that meaning?
One's wisdom is in the final stage is sevenfold. One, experience the end of. One, desire to know anything more. Two, desire to stay away from things. Three, desire to gain anything new. Four, desire to do anything. Five, sorrow. Six, fear. Seven, delusion.
Okay, now Patanjali has only said that the final wisdom comes in seven stages. It doesn't define what these stages are. So, you know, if you look at the commentators, they will give you a slightly different list depending on which commentator, who you read. Okay? But the whole process of purification of the mind, they say, goes through these seven stages of purification. And then you gain that final wisdom, final and pure intuition, pure wisdom, which is called prajna in this case. Okay? So we're not going to go through these seven stages because this list is different from what Vyasa has given.
Some of these things in the list, like the desire to stay away from anything or the desire to gain it or the desire to do anything. I mean, in today's day and age, if I don't do anything, I mean, nothing's going to get done.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, you know what these meanings are, but... Let's not go through that, because the list is different and it's explained differently, and I didn't get a chance to go through this list, to be honest. So I'm not in a state at this point to explain all this.
So where did Vyasa mention? You said Vyasa mentions it differently, right? So
Vyasa is the one who gave the original commentary on the Yoga Sutras.
Patanjali's
Yoga Sutras. His commentary is like the gold standard. Every commentator uses Vyasa's commentary as a source, as a reference material, and then tries to explain his own understanding based on that. And some people, at least most people who know, you know, the history and all that, they claim that Patanjali and Vyasa were almost compatriots. And therefore, apparently, Vyasa knew the mind of Patanjali very well. So his commentary is supposedly the most authentic, the most authoritative, and the most widely used by everybody. Okay, so it is impossible to understand what the sutras, some of the sutras mean. There's no way. You need somebody's commentary. And whose commentary would you use? Vyasa's.
How do you spell Vyasa? How do you spell that?
V-Y-A-S-A.
Sachidananda.
Well, you know, everybody, Satyananda also would have read Vyasa to develop an understanding of the Yoga Sutras. If you want to understand Yoga Sutras, you have to understand what Vyasa had to say about these sutras. Okay? I mean, his commentary was obviously in Sanskrit, but there are translations available. And then, of course, everyone gives their own interpretation of his commentary.
So
there are Sanskrit terms for all this, you know. The original commentary by Vyasa is called Bhashya. That's a Sanskrit term. And then commentary on that Bhashya is called Tika. and then of course there are Tika on Tika, you know. Commentary on the commentary. So there are many of those available. So, for example, based on Vyasa, again in, from the ancient times, there are people like who are the names that come to mind? Laura, you might help me. Who are the names mentioned in our in these texts? Vyasa's commentators.
Oh.
Vijnana Bhikshu, for example, is a very common name.
Yeah.
And again, an ancient commentator. Vachaspati Mishra. You know, those are some of the older commentators who wrote the commentary or the Tika on Vyasa's Bhashya. Okay. Now, most of the modern commentators, like Aranya, for example, we are reading that commentary. He uses commentary by all these people to write their own commentary.
Yeah,
now.
This is the Aranya. He talks about the seven kinds of insight, too.
Hmm. Yeah. What is his list? Is it the same thing?
See, one, that which has to be forsaken has been known. There is nothing more to know. Two, the causes of growth of the things to be given up have been attenuated. Three, liberation has become a matter of realization. Four, discriminative enlightenment has been recognized as a means of liberation. These are a little different. Five, Bodhi has fulfilled its function. Six, the attributes of Bodhi having been dislodged like boulders from the top of the hill are rushing toward dissolution and getting merged into the cause. And seven is, in the seventh state, the insight reveals Purusha as in himself, pure, self-luminous, and beyond any relation with the gunas. When these seven kinds of insights are acquired, the yogin may be called kushala or proficient. When the mind disappears, the yogin can be called a mukta kushala or the liberated one, because he then transcends the gunas.
Right. Mukta. Yeah, very good. Like I said, this list is not the same as Pratambad, but Swami Sachidananda has given. But this list is based on Vyasa's list. Okay. And this is translation. Again, you know, everything changes because Aranya, his commentary was written in Bengali language, okay, originally. And then this text that we are reading is an English translation by a guy called Mukherjee. And he has used his own style and his own knowledge of English.
From the Bengali to the English.
Then he has translated it from Bengali to English. Okay? And obviously he has added his own words and all that, which probably were never in the original Bengali. And Bengali, new translation from Sanskrit to Bengali, he has added some of his own stuff, so it's all.
It's just better to learn Sanskrit.
It's better to learn Sanskrit. That's why I have been making all my effort to learn Sanskrit, so I don't have to depend on any of these entirely. I need to depend on them some, but I can still be able to, I'm still able to make my own interpretation to some extent. I'm not there yet. So, still, even Sanskrit-wise, I have a long way to go before I can really understand all this. But at least, given the dictionary and given some of the meanings, you know, I can make some sense of all of it.
In Sanskrit, do the words have multiple meanings?
Yes,
in English?
Absolutely,
so
yes.
The definition that you choose
yes.
matters.
Yes, yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Each word can have multiple meanings, different interpretations, depending on the context. The only thing that is fixed in Sanskrit is pronunciation. It is extremely highly phonetic. What you write is what you read. What you read is what you write. Not like English. And coming to that, you know, I always like to give that example, which is from this British author by the name George Bernard Shaw. Anybody heard that name?
Yeah.
You know, he said that English is a very funny language because in English you are perfectly okay to spell fish as you can get away with that and say you are doing spelling fish. Either this or he says, yes. Either one is okay. How? Look at the word enough. This sounds like f, enough. That's the F of fish. Right? And this O, look at the word women. This O is like I. Or, if this is you, then look at the word busy. This you is the same as I. Okay? So this is okay. And then this T-I, lotion, for example. That's sh sound. So fish would be very easily spelled as G-H-O-T-I or G-H-U-T-I. And you are perfectly good to go. But not in Sanskrit. If you know the spelling, you know how to read it. If you know how to read it, you know the spelling. That's it. There are no two ways about it. So I'm going to skip on this Saptadha thing. Okay?
Which one?
You know, the one that we just read, there are 7 stages.
Yes, okay.
Okay, we're not going to go through these 7 stages because I don't understand them myself. And then that's one, number 27?
Yeah.
And then number 28 is something that we have done. I love that sutra. And we have done that before. And that's the introduction to the 8 limbs of yoga. Okay? So how do you get to that state of viveka khyati, or the pure discriminatory wisdom? How do you get there? By the practice of these 8 limbs of yoga. And what do they do? So again, you want to repeat that sutra after me. Yogang anushthanat ashuddhi kshaye jnana deeptihi a viveka khyatehe. Okay, so one more time. Yogang anushthanat अशुद्धि क्षये ज्ञान दीप्ति ही आ विवेक ख्याते है. Right, so this is a very beautiful shloka, the sutra, and it's very pregnant in meaning. Okay, so we have gone through this before, but very quickly, I'm going to just very quickly tell you the meaning of this. Yoga Anga are the 8 limbs of yoga. Anga mean the limbs of yoga. So by the practice of these 8 limbs of yoga, that's what it means. By the anushthanat means by the practice of. So by the practice or through the practice of these 8 limbs of yoga, ashuddhi kshaye. Ashuddhi means all the impurities of the mind. Kshaya means they drop out, they dwindle down, they become ineffective. Okay, they clean out. So all the impurities of the mind, they are cleaned out. Shuddhi kshaya. And what happens when there are no impurities of the mind? Jnana deeptihi. Deeptihi means light. So the light of knowledge, of the light of wisdom shines through. The light which was covered by the ego, now that you have cleared out all the impurities, you are able to see that light. Okay? Light at the end of the tunnel is now visible. The tunnel has been opened up now. Jnana deeptihi. How long does that happen? Ah means until you reach that state of viveka khyati that Patanjali wants you to get into. So viveka khyati means that pure discriminatory wisdom, where you know exactly what is right and what's wrong, where you know that when there is no avidya, remember we talked about that, when there is no ignorance, that state is called viveka khyati, and that leads to kaivalya, or the state of final liberation. You can get to that state once you have cleansed your mind of all the impurities, and you are able to see the light of wisdom, and you reach that state of pure uninterrupted flow of pure viveka khyati. All that can happen when you practice these 8 limbs of yoga. All right? Sales pitch for practicing eight limbs of yoga. Every day.
What are the eight limbs?
What are the eight limbs of yoga? That's what we
be.
So they start with yamas, niyamas, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dhyana, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Eight limbs of yoga. We talked about it. We spent almost a year on that, actually. But, you know, since you were not here, I understand that. And we will, I'm sure we'll do it some other time also. Okay. But now, before we conclude today, this is, you know, this is something that I started almost 2 years ago, this whole sequence. And in my understanding, I've completed that full set of sutra that I wanted to cover in these 2 years. Okay? So today is the kind of the last of the of these sessions. So the question that I asked was last time, what do you want to do next? Do you want to repeat all this whole sequence or do you want to cover some other text? Same book?
You mean starting back from book one?
No, I don't go in the sequence that this is. I have my own sequence that I covered in. Okay?
I'd like to do this.
So this is one option. Somebody else suggested Bhagavad Gita. You know, we can do that, you know, if there's an interest. So it all depends, you know, where the majority of the interest is. And
what was the other option? What was the other option?
Some of the people suggested Bhagavad Gita. You've studied the Gita at all?
Not deeply.
Yeah. So the suggestion was that can we maybe pick some representative shlokas from the Gita and go through those? Again, my goal will be to, if I go through these shlokas, I'll be going through the Sanskrit as well as the English translation. I'm more into now, you know, explaining the Sanskrit part as well, so that we get to the depth of the meaning. See, otherwise, if I don't read the Sanskrit part, I don't know what exactly they are saying. See, now I can interpret them in my own way and then I have a better way of explaining also, you know, that way.